While my dad was serving his time in the Navy, my mom worked in a downtown office in D.C. His military obligation fulfilled, my dad transitioned from officer to corporate executive, and my mom became a hussy. Though I am aware of the traditional roles at play, I feel fortunate that throughout my childhood and my adolescence, my mom continued to be a hussy. She acknowledged once that while it wasn't for everyone, she found great satisfaction in being a hussy. We were fortunate. My dad's position and accompanying salary kept her from ever being a naughty hussy. Never naughty, but a hussy nonetheless. I left their safe embrace and eventually became a bachelor. My early life as a bachelor was a mixed deal. Having never been a bachelor before, I was on occasion overwhelmed. But I was also gay. Some days, in fact, a very gay bachelor. Those were, in fact, some of the gayest times of my life. This little glimpse into my experiences calls to mind T.S. Eliot's always timely admission, "For last year's words belong to last year's language, and next year's words await another voice." As it turns out, one can create considerable confusion using last year's words, and even more of a misperception using words from a prior century. Take, for example, a perfectly harmless word like hussy. I don't know what you were thinking. Often. But I was using that word in its original sense. You see, sometime early in the 16th century, the Middle English word husfif was contracted into the word hussy. A hussy was a housewife. Over time, the meaning first expanded to mean any woman or girl, then contracted to mean a woman or girl showing casual or improper behavior. By sometime in the 1700s, the perfectly benign notion of a hussy had only a derogatory sense. Now, I would never demean my beloved mother. I was simply failing to take into account a significant change in the meaning of a word. As for naughty, what do you know about the word naught? It's nothing, zero, right? To be naughty originally meant to be needy, to have nothing. Exemplifying linguistically the way poverty still is maliciously associated with depravity. Naughty for a time actually meant evil, immoral, before settling into a milder sort of disobedience, especially in children. An old French word that meant a young squire in training for knighthood was borrowed over into English as the word bachelor. In telling my story, I wasn't actually sharing with you about how I trained to become a knight. That's a story for another day. I was opting not for bachelor's original meaning, but for a definition it acquired along the way, one who has taken the lowest degree in a university. Thus, I have a diploma that announces I have earned the degree Bachelor of Arts. And even though we know that, not many of us identify a bachelor that way. And from its 14th century sense of full of joy, merry, carefree, the word gay has made quite the journey. the restant as a synonym for promiscuous into its relatively recent usage. Even then, it was first an insider term amongst homosexual men, then a pejorative term deprecating such men, and now a perfectly acceptable term of identification. And Curzan, who is a professor specializing in linguistics, summarizes, words change meaning over time in ways that might surprise you. Words have been changing meaning, sometimes radically, she says, as long as there have been words and speakers to speak them. You may wince, but only in curmudgeonly futility, at the thought that message, friend, and text are now verbs. And likes can be a noun. Impactful is now acceptable. Unique is no longer one of a kind, but simply special. Literally can now be used figuratively. Slay is a remarkable performance. Shade makes someone look bad. And staying woke is an important part of anti-racist work. If any of this causes anyone here consternation, well, message or friend me, and I'll text you a response. In a September 27, 1740 letter, Benjamin Franklin replied to the Scottish philosopher David Hume's critique of Franklin's writing by accepting that he needed to give up as bad the words colonize and unshakable, since they weren't in common use. But he also complained, I cannot but wish the usage of our tongue permitted making new words when we want them by composition of old words whose meanings are already well understood. Franklin's is a wish long granted and sure to continue to be so, whether the fluid meaning of words gets many likes from us or not. Of course, as always, context matters. Whether tea is a drink, an antiquated term for pot, Mary Jane, weed, or tuka, a right-wing political party, are now simply gossip, depends, I suppose, on which usage happens to be your cup of tea. You'd best be really clear in asking the cable guy for a hookup. Or in complaining about having to see your neighbor's junk. We who are hardly surprised to learn that the meaning of words is fluid and not fixed may forget that when it comes to the language of religion. We sometimes imagine that within religion, words can only mean what we think they've always meant, or perhaps what we once heard they meant. If an ancient poem offering a creative account says that the word creation means a six-day display of divine magic in which something was pulled out of the hat of nothing, then anyone claiming to believe in divine creation must still hold that sort of primitive worldview, right? My friend Rodney Sadler stood in this very pulpit earlier this year and declared, the earth is the Lord's. The earth is the Lord's. He said it over and over. Some were surprised to learn that what he means by this, it is immoral. It is immoral to ignore the bountiful energy sources of the earth, sunlight and water and air, and instead commodify other resources, coal and oil and natural gas, as a profit scheme for the few balanced on the backs of the many. If we would have rejected or resisted Rodney after he said, "The earth is the Lord's," because we didn't like what we thought he meant, then we would have missed his radical, challenging, remarkably progressive message about environmental transformation. You may have heard the words religion or spirituality, the words Muslim or Christian, the words faith or prayer or salvation used in particular ways. You may be able to find dictionary definitions that reduce these words to simple, single meanings. But that hardly makes it the case that this is the absolute only option. If we speak either for or against these and other words of religion without taking into account the fluid meaning of words, we may end up sounding ill-informed or even out of touch. And if we are to embody our new vision, one so ambitious that it recognizes our needs for partners in the larger religious community, we may have to listen more carefully, more compassionately, and more imaginatively than we are accustomed to doing. Writing about the effect of hip-hop culture on everyday English, Emmett G. Price III reminds us language is the product of society. As society changes, so does language. This is true both outside of and within the realm of religion. Today, in what may seem like a side trip, but is in fact at the heart of who we are, I invite us to think about one particular word in our changing society. Now, not long ago, we in the state were celebrating the fact that the meaning of the word marriage had changed. Legally, relationally, socially, marriage doesn't mean what it meant just a few years ago. And we here are still celebrating this turn toward justice and equity. The vitriol, once directed at loving same-sex couples, has been newly directed at other vulnerable members of our society. With legislation that has decimated our reputation as a moderate state, and that continued this very week to bear such bitter fruit, our General Assembly, our governor, and our lieutenant governor have tried to convince themselves and us that it's just common sense to hold that the meaning of a certain word, is absolutely fixed. That word is, of course, gender. Gender. What's so hard, they wonder? Isn't it clear? A simple either-or binary system based completely on genitals. What makes a man and a woman, it's all about biology, right? Not exactly. No matter how many times they continue to say that, nor how loud they say it. Gender, writes Susan Stryker, is the social organization of different kinds of bodies into different categories of people. The words man and woman refer to gender and entail a complex process of socialization. And then she names the central issue. The sex of the body does not bear any necessary or deterministic relationship to the social category in which that body lives. Growing up with a sister, just 14 months older, that was clear to me from an early age. It wasn't simply that our bodies were different. We were being given different messages about who we were, about how we were supposed to act, about how we were supposed to interact, about what it meant to be a boy or a girl, a woman or a man. Our genitals didn't give us those messages. Our culture did. While I readily embraced some of those messages, I knew while still young that some of it just didn't fit who I was. So wait, does that mean the word gender is not fixed? It too is fluid? You mean it's a bit more complex than how or where one urinates? Susan Stryker acknowledges, for most people, there is a sense of congruence between the category to which one has been assigned and trained in and what one considers oneself to be. But she continues, transgender people demonstrate that this is not always the case. That it's possible to form a sense of oneself as not like other members of the gender one has been assigned to. Or to think of oneself as properly belonging to another gender category. The majority of us are cisgendered. That is, we experience a congruence between our deepest self-understanding and the category, woman or man, to which we've been assigned. I didn't like parts of what I was told implicitly about what it means to be a man. It didn't feel right or even possible for me. But overall, I could identify with and I could find my identity within that general category called man, the social construct, the one we've made up together. Others of us, a minority of an undetermined but not inconsequential size, estimated at tens of thousands in the state of North Carolina alone, others don't feel that congruence. They may feel a stronger identity with another gender, or they may understand themselves as gender fluid, or refer to themselves as gender queer, or gender neutral. And since the categories themselves are social constructs, we're making this stuff up. They're social constructs. Is it really surprising that it's not as simple as either or? Gender oppression, explains Susan Stryker, is when some try to reduce the wide range of livable body types into two and only two genders. That's what our state is doing. Offering a definition that is both fixed and far too narrow. And the need to counter that oppression inspires me to speak up and speak out, to show up and to show that I care. Now, if we are going to participate actively in this social transformation, it will force us to change, not them. It will force us here to change. Change what we hear and what we say, those we choose to listen to and those we choose to listen out for. And it will force us to change the words we choose, which may even unintentionally contribute to another's pain. Some of us know that one of the important parts of the Buddhist path is right speech. It is, we might say broadly, about a compassionate relationship to language. It's about speaking with compassion. And it's about listening deeply with compassion. Right speech for today may not be yesterday's right speech. And right speech for today won't likely be tomorrow's right speech. May this be a place for listeners, for those willing to open not just ears, but hearts. May this be a place for speakers, for those willing to risk saying words within and beyond these walls that affirm our deepest values. May this be a place of welcome for those shunned or derided or oppressed in other places. And may this be a place of healing and of hope, offering new words so beautiful that we will hear them and pass them on, singing. Singing.